Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. This is a big moment in our history today because we figured out this is going to be a two-parter before we started recording, which is just huge for us.
I know. Just exercising a little bit of forethought goes a long way. And I thank you, Ben, for pointing that out. It is a milestone indeed. For a second, I thought you were going to say some like historic anniversary or something. But I realized that was not the case. I'm so sorry. You're Ben. Yeah.
You're Noel.
Uh-huh. I continue to be. Yes, sir.
And that's our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Casey Pegram. How do you feel about this, Casey? Does that mean we're going to like not have to retroactively like shoehorn in our little bumpers, or we apologize for making it a two-parter?
This is brand new territory that we're exploring here today. Yeah, it's crazy. We're going to get to think about the outro and the intro and where to split it, and yeah, it's going to be interesting.
It's a lot of pressure.
That's true. Yeah, we better get it right.
Yes. Well, we'll get it something, I think. This is a fascinating episode, fascinating topic today. It's something that the three of us were not very aware of before we started working with Gabe and diving into the story. But long story short, the headline for this is that Jamaica was once the HQ for Jewish pirates, which is something that, you know, when we think of pirates, most people think of like Pirates of the Caribbean, some kind of Johnny Depp-esque ragamuffin and rogue, right? Lovable rogue.
Totally.
But the truth is different. Pirates were very diverse. They, depending on the ship, they had a more democratic existence than a lot of laborers at the time. But we're going to explore a story about pirates that you may not have heard before.
If I might read a small excerpt from Ed Kritzler's Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean. Speaking of which, guys, quick poll. Do you say Caribbean or Caribbean?
I go back and forth.
Yeah, I'm the same way. It's kind of, I don't know, whatever sounds good in the moment.
I mean, sure feels to me like the ride at Disneyland is Pirates of the Caribbean.
Absolutely, right. Yes. And that phrase, it's always Caribbean.
Okay, cool.
It's like data or data.
100%. Or if you're talking about that Billy Ocean song, it's Caribbean.
The ocean and the desert.
Or you would say like Caribbean food. You wouldn't say Caribbean food. Right.
See, okay. This is great. We have cleared this up entirely. It's definitely a tastemaker type situation, but also there are clear cases where one or the other is more appropriate. We can put that to bed now. So, again, back to the excerpt. Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean. At the dawn of the Age of Discovery, when Spain's monarchs banished them to purify and thereby unite their nation, followers of the Law of Moses sailed with the explorers and marched with the conquistadors. With the discovery and settlement of the New World, they took solace in the hope of finding there a haven, or at least putting distance between themselves and the Holy Terror.
Yeah, you know what? Let's go ahead and carry this out a little bit further. So Kritzler goes on to say that, unlike a lot of other explorers, these individuals didn't have a home to return to. They were some of the first, quote-unquote, foreigners to permanently settle in the New World, and a lot of them kept their religious beliefs secret. I particularly like how he breaks it down in this next quote, where he says, "Jewish explorers, conquistadors, cowboys, and pirates were similar in spirit to other settlers, but while others came to conquer, search for gold, and collect a," his words, not ours, quote, "bevy of Indian women, they came as well to settle a land beyond the tentacles of the Inquisition. This early history is largely unknown because few knew these pioneers were Jewish. They would pose often as Christians to avoid further persecution in the New World."
That's right. And I'm assuming, Ben, in that movie trailer-esque excerpt I read from Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean, the Holy Terror is referring to those that would persecute them for their faith, like them being Jewish and the Holy Terror being what? the status quo of just Christianity, Catholicism. What are
the Inquisition?
You talking about, do you think? Ah, yes, that's right. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, except when you do, and you become a pirate to escape it.
Mm-hmm. And it's strange. It's history that is still relatively obscure to a lot of people. Each colony in the New World had an underground community of Jewish people that were known only to each other and to some other Jewish people, maybe in adjacent colonies or nearby colonies. According to Kritzler, and this is also a quote I'm pulling from the Daily Beast on the Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean, I'm going to be thinking about that. But according to Kritzler, these individuals did pretty well in the economy of the time as merchants, as traders, and ship owners. And as long as they kept up kind of a lip service pretense toward Christianity, and as long as they did a good job as shippers, as merchants and traders, no one bothered to question them too closely. But once they established this massive trade network, the powers that be started to consider them expendable.
Yeah, it's true. And it really was a case of fleeing, where they wanted to go someplace that they would not be persecuted for those secrets and for their faith. And oftentimes, some of these Jewish merchants of the sea fled to Middle Eastern countries, like those in the Ottoman Empire. And another huge wave of these folks landed in Jamaica. In fact, there were so many Jewish folks fleeing for Jamaica that they actually occupied a massive number of Jamaican legislative seats. So many, in fact, that in the 19th century, Jamaica's parliament was the only one in the New World that didn't have sessions on Saturdays because of Shabbat.
It's fascinating and tragic how European expansion across the Atlantic Ocean occurred in step with a new wave of anti-Semitism. The same month that Cristobal Colon, or Columbus, set sail, right, trying to find a route to Asia, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella actually ordered the expulsion of all Muslims and Jews from Spain. And then Portugal followed up. So people are trying to escape somewhere, to your point. And Jamaica became a home away from home of sorts. It was anomalous at this time because Jamaica was essentially a private possession of Christopher Columbus and his family. He had been awarded the ownership of Jamaica in perpetuity back in 1494.
Does that mean he personally benefited from any of their cash crops and exports and things like that? Like, was that even a thing yet? Like all the sugar cane and other farming commodities that would come out of Jamaica, which we know was a thing.
He owned everything. You know what I mean?
That's wild, man. That is wild.
Yeah. And before we think that is just something consigned to the dustbin of history, I will point out there is an island in Hawaii that is owned by a single family. It's a big island, and they also suppress technology there. You literally cannot go. It's like a fiefdom. But anyway, that's what Christopher Columbus had, and his heirs, who inherited Jamaica from him, kept their domain free from the Inquisition. So it does make sense for the Jewish diaspora to travel there, because it's one of the places Spain can't get you.
That's right. And then in 1655, this was a year after a lot of Jewish refugees had arrived in Jamaica from Dutch Brazil, which is a thing. The island wasn't being particularly looked after by its, its viceroy. I don't know. What would Columbus have been owner, I guess. He was doing a pretty shoddy job of taking care of business and keeping a good watch on his possession. And it was seized by Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Totally hijacked. Pulled out from under him. No more island for Chrissy Columbo.
Yep. And the leader of this attack was one Admiral William Penn, who will go on to be the father of William Penn Jr., who will go on to later found Pennsylvania. Religious freedom was in pretty good shape under the British rule. By 1720, somewhere around 20% of the residents of Kingston, the capital of Jamaica, were descendants of Spanish Portuguese Jews.
So at this point, the Jamaican Jewish population was pretty well entrenched, and they were looking for some more opportunities at sea, some adventures, if you will. And they started captaining ships. This jpost.com article lists a few, one of which was the Queen Esther, the Prophet Samuel, and the Shield of Abraham. So they were really leaning into their Jewish faith with the mastheads, you know, of their ships, right? And they really started kind of clustering around the Caribbean, looking for sunken treasure, and sometimes straight up robbing people.
Yes, yeah, that's correct. We will mention, though, that they had a specific bias. They wanted to attack Spanish and Portuguese ships because this was seen as payback for the torture of Jewish people conducted by the Inquisition. This was also, by the way, retaliation for confiscation of property. We have to remember, when the Inquisition persecutes people, they often have laws that incentivize the investigators, the inquisitors. And one of those laws is the idea that if you can punish someone, right, for blasphemy or punish them for being a witch or whatever, then you are entitled to all or some of their worldly goods. So sometimes people were getting persecuted just because they were well-to-do, but then also socially vulnerable. So some of these crews, we have to be very clear about this, some of these crews did not see themselves as criminals so much as like adventurers and people fighting the power that was the Inquisition. This is where we get to a really, I think, a fun part of the episode, which is busting some pirate myths. I set it up at the beginning, but Casey, Noel, as you guys know, pirating was kind of egalitarian, like surprisingly so back then.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you think of pirates as like almost like Vikings, which also didn't we bust some Viking myths recently in our unicorn horn episode? So similarly, so they were more organized than one would think. One would be led to believe you think that Vikings and pirates alike were just bloodthirsty rapers and pillagers, and there certainly was some of that going on. But they had a pretty egalitarian situation where it was much more democratic than you would be led to believe. There was a sense of equality among the ranks of some of these pirates, and that is a big part of what attracted some of these displaced Jews to join in that lifestyle, because it looked like an opportunity to be treated as equals and to make a little cash while they were at it. Pirates were not just, you know, going willy-nilly up and down the coast, burning things to the ground with no sense of order. They were totally organized and fans of democracy, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's not necessarily because of some sort of noble, altruistic motivation. It's because it's better for business. It's a more sustainable model. So that's why they would do things like elect their captain. It's brilliant when you think about it. You know, this is an age where there are still like press gangs and people are getting their drinks drugged somewhere in Europe and they're waking up as essentially a slave on a ship. But in the world of piracy, the crew can elect their captain, which means the crew probably picks a captain they like, and a mutiny is less likely. They also elect the quartermaster. The captain has certain, like, emergency powers, you could call them, but otherwise, he has to check with the gang if he wants to do stuff during peacetime. I think it's inspiring. I'm not saying that I condone piracy or that I would want to live on a pirate ship, but I think the power of the vote is cool, and I think it's really cool that pirates knew that.
Wouldn't it be funny if the word quartermaster was actually pronounced something like quarmster, you know, sort of the way boatswains pronounced bosun, one of these inexplicable nautical terms that just does not read at all on paper the way it's pronounced?
Or Worcester?
Exactly, like Worcester. But what if quartermaster was actually quister? I don't know, just spitballing here, but it's true. I mean, the captain certainly was the boss, but it was a power that came with respect, literally the respect of his underlings, I guess, because they're the ones that put this person in power. So you're absolutely right, Ben. There was a lot of checks and balances, shall we say, built into this system. Pretty cool. Then we move into another era of wing of piracy called privateers, which is, you could, I guess, refer to as legal piracy, because it much more has to do with reclaiming sunken wreckage on behalf of a company and getting to keep some of that money or getting to do it for salvage or whatever, or things like mercenary bounty hunting and the like, right?
Yeah. So privateers are legal pirates at this time. They are doing things that would be against the law, but they're doing it with the explicit support of a sovereign nation. So imagine that you are a bank robber. If you're listening to this, you and I and Casey Knoll, we got together, we made a heist crew, and we started robbing banks. That's illegal, right? But imagine that we have the support of the government of Canada. Like, we're right on the Canadian-US border, and Canada says, we love the way you all rob banks. We want to make your Apple Dumpling Gang an official arm of the Canadian war machine. So you will be pirates for us.
But the Canadians seem so friendly. I don't know that they would jump into business with these opportunist pirate weirdos.
Yeah, but in this example, we're bank robbers that Canada is approving of. For these folks, I guess one interesting difference in the comparison is that these European countries are paying people to start trouble and disrupt trade lines half a world away.
Look, and I'm really sorry I characterized pirates as opportunist weirdos. That's the whole point of today's episode. We're busting these myths. You know, everyone's an opportunist. They're just looking for opportunity on the high seas because they want to make a better life for themselves and their families. And while there certainly was some absolute baddie type behavior, I think all pirates were not created equally awful. I think that's sort of the takeaway here. And it's interesting to think about.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a privateer, you're a pirate with a piece of paper, an official letter that says you're allowed to break these laws and engage in this economic warfare. And in return, you give that monarchy or that state power a cut of the booty, which sounds weird to say that way. Okay, you give them a cut of the earnings.
I like the cut of your booty.
Yeah, cut of the booty.
Yep, I'm using that.
I did not see myself coining the phrase cut of the booty. But here we are. It's a Friday,
folks. It is.
So the thing is that if there wasn't a war going on that the privateers could participate in, they just went back to being regular pirates. And they would pull out that letter if they ever got in trouble. They would essentially, it's so weird. This is going to be something for all the vexillologists in the crowd. The difference between these ships in peacetime and in wartime was mainly the flag. If they're working for Britain, they're flying the Union Jack or, the same thing for Holland. But then if they're not currently privateering, they just throw up the old Jolly Roger, which I don't know about you guys, but have you ever looked at the old real examples of pirate flags?
Is the design different?
It's still, there's still like a skull crossbones thing, but there's a lot of variation there that hasn't happened that I was unaware of. So you'll see one with a clothed person handing a cup to a skeleton. A skeleton with an arrow pointing at a heart, like a Valentine's Day card heart, and then wearing a crown. It's interesting. They're more detailed than I thought they were.
That sounds pretty cool. That sounds like some almost like tarot card imagery, a little bit. I like that. Okay, so I think we've laid the groundwork for this thing, this phenomenon of Jewish pirates traversing the high seas in search of great riches. And I think this is a good spot to close out this episode one, and save some of the notable and individual stories of pirates and privateers of the Jewish faith from throughout history. I think that gets an episode on its own. What do you think, guys?
100% agreed. We'll also solve the mystery of why a lot of people haven't heard of Jewish pirates in the modern day. What are we talking about? We'll tell you in our next episode. We hope that you enjoyed part one of Jamaica and Jewish Pirates, and we hope you join us for part two. In the meantime, thanks as always to our super producer, the Jolly Roger of your heart and mine, Casey Pegram.
And the Jolly Rancher of my soul, Casey Pegram indeed. Yeah, I know this one was a little on the short side, but we thought it was a clean break to get into some really cool stories of some of these badass individuals in the next episode. Until then, huge thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, Jonathan Strickland, the Quizster.
Big thanks to Yves Jeffcoat, thanks to Gabe Luzier, and Casey, no, thanks to you guys.
Ahoy, mateys.
We got so far without doing terrible puns.
See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.